Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. Campaigners will start dropping in with stories from the Pacific, Asia, and the Middle East. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. Asian armies for hire, the pros and cons of privatising war, and some colourful profiles of modern-day mercenaries. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and I'm joined today by Pacific expert and author Nick McClellan. There's a lot of spotlight shining on the privatisation of armed forces in Iraq, but little attention being given to the fact that what's happening in Iraq is just the tip of a very large iceberg. All over the world, governments are contracting out war and peace work to private companies. Military forces are now being called security forces. What used to be done by publicly controlled armies is now being done by private transnationals, which are making handsome profits in this new global market in the process. And many commentators are saying, why not? Water's being privatised. Energy's being privatised. All of our public services are up for grabs. And isn't our army just another public service? Well, not really. Up until recently, it's been thought that when it comes to the legitimate use of violence, then our governments and the bureaucracies that they control should have a monopoly. Because when it comes to the privatisation of security, what we're talking about is contracting out the use of force, contracting out the right to kill. Today we're examining the results of this contracting. Just what is this global phenomenon and how will it affect our international landscape? Nick McClellan has recently written a report on the high number of Fijians who are now working for private security companies overseas. How many about, Nick, and why were they recruited?
Well, today there's about 3,000 Fiji Islanders working in Iraq and Kuwait for private military contractors, and that's part of a broader pattern. And we've seen a fundamental shift in recent times because historically there have been mercenaries, people who've been hired for money to fight rather than for commitment to the country, and that goes right back through the ages. But it's been a feature particularly since the Vietnam War, where the United States suffered so many casualties. There were over 50,000 dead, many hundreds of thousands of people wounded. Even a small country like Australia involved in Vietnam had 500 soldiers killed. And so the Americans moved away from the draft and towards an all-volunteer army, but couldn't get the number of recruits and soldiers that they needed in the period since the end of the Cold War. So over the last decade or more, they've turned to private companies. And so the Pentagon spends about $270 billion a year on private contractors. Intelligence services in America, $42 billion a year. So it's big money. Looking for troops, as well as recruiting people from the United States, they've also turned to smaller countries around the world, what they call third country nationals, to fill out the roles that are needed, both for security work and also just for logistics. For example, transporting equipment into Baghdad to support the US Army in its operations in Iraq at the moment. And in the case I've been studying in Fiji, it's a small island nation in the South Pacific, only 850,000 people. Yet, as I say, up to 3,000 people have been working in Iraq in a range of roles, some in military roles and in security roles, protecting convoys, protecting diplomats, protecting key infrastructure like government buildings or oil pipelines and so on.
So it's defensive and not an offensive role then, Nick?
One of the features that's been highlighted in recent months has been the fact that there are, in fact, offensive roles. Some of these companies are contracted to provide security for US officials, for example. One recent incident in September 2007 with a company called Blackwater has really brought this to the fore, where there's allegations that Blackwater contractors, former Special Forces soldiers, were protecting State Department officials as they transited through Baghdad, and they opened fire on civilians. There's a dispute about whether they were attacked first, but a lot of eyewitnesses say that they attacked without provocation, and 20 civilians were killed in this shootout. Now, in the course of a much broader war, that's not the only atrocity that's happened in Iraq, but it's raised a lot of concern because Blackwater is not licensed by the Iraqi government. It's operating at the behest of the United States, and people involved in Blackwater are really unaccountable.
We've heard quite a bit about Blackwater recently, and also we hear a lot about Halliburton, that company who used to be headed by Dick Cheney, who's the US Vice President at the moment. What are the other companies that are involved in this, what seems to be, very lucrative market?
According to recent figures, there are 181 companies operating in Iraq as private military contractors. Indeed, they've got their own association called the International Peace Operations Association, which is it's a great name. It's a lobby group for companies like Blackwater. But they're not just American. The big companies like Blackwater, Vinel, Kroll and others are supplemented by many from Britain. A major company called Armour Group, which is UK-based, has been very active. And companies from Britain like Global Risk Strategies or Aegis have got major contracts.
What is it about the Fijians that security companies are finding attractive? Is it that they are putting up their hands, or are security companies actually actively looking for Fijian nationals?
A number of companies, particularly British ones, have been looking to Fiji because they know that Fiji has churned out a lot of soldiers over the years. Fijians have been recruited into the British Army since the Second World War. Fiji was a former British colony, only gaining independence in 1970. And so there's been a historic connection between Britain and Fiji. And indeed today there are 3,000 Fijians in the British Army, some of whom are serving in Iraq. But private companies like Global Risk Strategies and subsidiaries of Armour Group have set up offices in Suva to recruit personnel. One reason was that Fijians have had a lot of history in the Middle East. For many years, Fiji has sent members of its armed forces, the Republic of Fiji military forces, into the United Nations peacekeeping operations. And indeed, from the 1980s, Fijians made up a major component of UNIFIL, the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon. But when Israel withdrew from Lebanon in 2000, by 2002, Fijians were no longer needed for deployment to Lebanon. So you had a pool of soldiers and former soldiers who'd been in Lebanon, some of whom spoke Arabic, many of whom knew the Middle East, and they were looking for work. So at that time, British and US companies saw them as an incredible source of recruitment for their operations in the build-up towards the war in Iraq. Because today, there are more private military contractors operating in Iraq than US soldiers in the US Army and US Marines. So the number of private military contractors playing a role in security, in transport, in communications, logistics, is greater than the number of people in the US armed forces under the American flag.
Well, I want to go back to Fiji because it's such an interesting case study, Nick, but Carolyn Holmquist has just called in. She's written a policy report for the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, taking an international snapshot of private security companies. She's now a doctoral candidate with King's College in London. Caroline, when you did your report back in 2005, you estimated that over 100 private security companies were operating in around 100 countries worldwide. What services are they providing?
First of all, I should point out that these figures aren't actually mine. I'm quoting Peter Singer at Brookings Institution in Washington, who is one of the few people that have come up with numerical estimates as regards the industry size. One of the notorious difficulties in doing research in this area is that there just isn't enough available data on either the size or the scope of the industry. What's clear, though, is that it's an industry that spans a very wide spectrum of services, from the non-lethal, non-armed services that could include anything from training, advice, risk assessment, demining services, logistics support, communications, two services then that are closer, let's say, to the military front line, One of the other notorious difficulties in studying this subject is that what may be defensive in one set of circumstances is going to be perceived as offensive in a different set of circumstances. That is why merely defining the services that, companies carry out don't necessarily give us the whole picture. Offensive, defensive depends on the circumstances, and there are certain clear-cut cases, obviously, such as when private companies have been hired by governments actually to combat rebel troops, as was done in Angola in the mid-1990s in Sierra Leone. That's the highest end of the spectra, if you like.
And so what other countries are employing these private security contracting firms? Like 100 countries around the world, that's a lot of countries.
To categorise it in a simple way, we've primarily two kinds of countries. We've got the countries that are mostly exporting these services. The key exporters are the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Israel, reportedly growing in Russia, China. The US and the UK are amongst the biggest exporters of private military and private security services. That means that these companies do work for the US and the UK government when they are deployed abroad in different ways or in support of tasks that the governments have set. The other large group of states are the weak states, the states that are fundamentally lacking in capacity, that have a lack of functioning state institutions, such as we see in many of the weak and fragile states in parts of Africa. In these cases, the question of outsourcing becomes a very different one, because in most of these cases, it's not a deliberate choice on the part of government to outsource. Rather, it's a question of the private sector simply stepping in and filling a vacuum for whoever happens to be able to pay for their services, be that a multinational corporation, an NGO, or a government.
One of the concerns about contracting the use of violence to a private company is that its use then remains confidential rather than public. What kind of problems are there here, Carolyn?
I think that transparency is possibly the biggest impediment to any proper discussion about the industry's existence to begin with. It's difficult to discuss as a whole because it includes such different types of companies, from companies who actually do make an effort to be transparent and who pride themselves on being different from companies that have lesser qualms about what kinds of services and to whom they provide. If we have a company A, for example, working with something like demining, which is generally seen as, a respectable task and carried out for respectable clients, such as the UN, it's going to be a very different issue about transparency when you compare it to companies that are providing armed services in a very hostile environment. But in general, across the board, transparency is one of the key issues.
I'd like to bring Nick McClellan into our conversation now, Caroline. Nick, what concerns do you have about the privatisation of armies?
Well, I think that question that Caroline's raised about transparency, accountability and regulation are really at the heart of the issue. When soldiers in armed forces go to war, there are a range of regulations, of rules, the rules of war, international law, that can control their operation, even down to the level of what they call rules of engagement, of when a soldier can fire their weapon and when they can't. One of the great concerns that's been raised, and you see it very much in the situation in Iraq, is whether people working for private military contractors come under the same rules of law, rules of war, rules of engagement. The real question is for accountability too. When soldiers in an army breach the rules of war, they can face punishment under that country's regulations. And yet often you don't see the same sort of punishment meted out to people engaged in similar activities in private companies. One of the classic cases was the incidents at Abu Ghraib, where there was concern that a number of prisoners being held at this prison in Baghdad, or just outside of Baghdad, had been tortured and maltreated. People will know from the international media coverage that some low-level soldiers from the US Army were punished for crimes committed at Abu Ghraib, and yet a number of the people working there were not part of the US Armed Forces, but were working for private companies. So, for example, 100% of the translators were employed by a corporation named Titan, and about half the interrogators came from another company called CACI. And none of the people involved from those companies have been charged or brought before a court, even though the US Army found that over a third of the offences of maltreatment, of torture, were committed by people from those private entities rather than soldiers who were involved in guarding and supervising the prisoners. And the United Nations is looking at this. The United Nations Rapporteur on Mercenaries is involved in a series of visits to countries trying to look at the recruitment, the accountability of private military contractors, simply because it's becoming a growing and increasing international phenomenon.
Mm. Caroline's paper for the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, actually does make a range of recommendations about what is needed to regulate this industry. Can you run through with us some of the most important recommendations that you made, Caroline?
Of course. One of the starting points for discussion is obviously going to be international humanitarian law and human rights law, law that applies to states and individuals in the international system, where private companies are not understood in the legal context the same way as states and individuals are. Laws apply to states and individuals and not to companies as entities. That's a starting point for this discussion. It indicates the need to take other measures, measures beyond the existing international law. And it needs to happen at various different levels. The type of law that's going to have the greatest chance of being effective is obviously going to be national law, where governments make sure that law is enforced in their territory. That's both the governments where the companies are actually employed, the host governments, if you like, and the countries that export these services or who have companies based in their territory that sell these services abroad. Both of these two states need to have national legislation in place that effectively addresses the industry. The second level is the international level, and that's the most difficult level, as we can see with the deficiencies that we currently have in international law. As we also know from the UN discussions and the UN Convention Against Mercenaries, which was written in 1989, was actually ratified by the requisite, I think it's 22 or 26, somewhere in between, number of states until after 2000, I think it was 2002. So that shows that even agreeing on a definition of what mercenaries are is excruciatingly difficult on the international level, and it took various years, and it's still not signed by more than between 20 and 30 states.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Caroline. What is the problem with definition there?
It's partly a political problem. The current definition that stems from the Geneva Conventions is one that's extremely restrictive. It places about six or seven different criteria on who can be considered a mercenary, and all of these criteria have to apply at the same time. The most difficult one is that in order to be considered a mercenary, it has to be proven that you're engaged purely in the interest of personal financial gain. And that's a difficult thing to prove. And I think one of the reasons the criteria was set so restrictively was possibly because this was at a time when we had various national liberation movements around the world who were very concerned that they wouldn't be labeled mercenaries. And so you had to make sure that the definition could never intersect with somebody who had a political agenda that was regarded as legitimate internationally, such as the national liberation movements in various places.
Mm.
So that's the reason, I think, part of the reason at least, for the origins of this restrictive definition of mercenaries and the difficulty in getting agreement. And I think that's still visible today in many ways.
Going back to your primary recommendations.
Yeah, so the one thing I would add to that is that the idea that we can effectively ban the entire industry globally, which some people suggest, I think is at this stage unrealistic. And possibly also actually not something we would want to do, because there are a number of services within this industry upon which the international community greatly relies. Something such as demining, for example, which is very much carried out by private companies. The more sensitive types of tasks clearly need to be regulated, and the fact that it hasn't happened yet is quite scandalous. But if the UK government, for example, is anything to go by, we've seen a complete stalling of any discussion on this issue, in fact, since 2002, when a green paper was published in response to the 1997 Arms to Africa affair, in which a private British company was found to be supplying support to the Sierra Leonean government in countering the rebel forces in that country at the same time as there was a UN weapons embargo on Sierra Leone, which meant that a UK company was actually in violation of the UN's embargo.
Yes, you're talking about Tim Spicer there and his company Sandline, yes?
Yes.
We're going to be picking up that story later in the program. Caroline, can I ask two quick questions? Firstly, have there been any prosecutions of private companies, private security firms around the world anywhere at the moment?
That's a question that's impossible to answer. There hasn't been anything, as far as I know, under any of the international courts, the International Criminal Court, for example. No, there hasn't. I'm sure there has been on a national level, but clearly there's been also difficulty in bringing proceedings towards individuals employed by these companies, simply because whatever crime occurs in a setting that is different from the area of jurisdiction where they will be tried. So a US company operating in Iraq, obviously US lawyers and so on are going to have a hard time finding out exactly what happened, because not only did it not happen in the US, but it might also be impossible to travel to the area where it did happen.
Yes. And finally, one potential problem that occurred to me when I was reading your report was that if we rely too heavily on private contractors, then there's a possibility that they'll be prepared to turn on legitimate governments if they're paid enough money to do that later down the track. What do you think of that, Caroline?
It's a tricky question to ask, and it's because, as I've been trying to emphasise, it includes such different types of companies in such different areas. There have been rumours that rebel groups in both Angola and Colombia have periodically hired private security companies for various types of support. That's unconfirmed as far as I know, and it's certainly not any of the companies that we would recognise in an international discussion. It's not the big players. But theoretically, that a company could take on such tasks, at the moment, it's very difficult to stop that were it to happen. And that is exactly what points in the direction of the great need for international regulation of this issue.
That was Caroline Holmquist. Check out her report, written for the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, entitled Private Security Companies, The Case for Regulation. Caroline, how can people access your policy paper?
As far as I know, it's still available on the website, just www.sipri.org.
That was a fascinating global overview, Caroline. Thank you very much for being part of the program today.
Bye. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR, chatting with Pacific commentator and journalist Nick McClellan. And today, we're taking aim at the privatisation of war and conflict, or the provision of security as it's being sold. How important are the wages that Fijians are getting from international security work to the Fijian economy, Nick?
That's really the centre of the whole operation. There are many people in Fiji, like in other developing countries, that are looking for work overseas. There's a lack of jobs in the formal sector in a small island developing state like Fiji, and so increasingly Fijians are moving offshore looking for opportunities. For many Fijian men, joining the army has been a source of employment, and Fiji's army is by and large indigenous Fijians. Historically, Fiji has gained a lot of funding from the United Nations for its peacekeeping operations, and you've had not only regular soldiers from the Fiji military forces, but also what they call territorial or reserve soldiers going into these peacekeeping operations. So you've got a pool of 10,000 men who could potentially be recruited for these sort of operations, having had military experience overseas. One feature of the current situation is that the recruiting companies like Global Risk Strategies and others have come in offering big money, paying $3,000 a week as compared to, say, $300 a week in Fiji. So it's 10 times the sort of money that you'd get working in a lowly paid job in Fiji, much better money than a farmer from Fiji could earn involved in local activities. And there just aren't the jobs that can provide the sort of things that people are looking for, which is providing money for school fees, for housing, for improving people's lives in the village in a small country. And so Fiji today earns over 300 million Fiji dollars every year from remittances, and that's larger now than key sectors of the economy like sugar or garments, even tourism. And so remittances and earning cash are a really central part of the government of Fiji's economy. And that's why, until now, there's been a reluctance for the Fiji government to try and step in and regulate the recruiters that have been offering big money to young Fijians to go off to Iraq, even in spite of the risks. Over 20 Fijians have been killed so far in Iraq, which is proportionally a huge tally.
Yes, and I understand that some Fijians are joking that they're worth more dead than alive. There's an aspect of mortgaging your bodies in this process. Tell us about the insurance payments, Nick.
The insurance is central. A friend in Fiji used to joke that families would choose the youngest, dumbest son and send them off. And if they were injured, the insurance payments would be wonderful. And when you look at the costs, it's said with a certain humour, but the substance is real. Over 20 Fijians have been killed, many others wounded. Insurance rates have been up to $150,000, $200,000 US, which for a family in Fiji is an enormous amount of money. And so the attractions for people going, with the pay rates, the insurance rates, the benefits that are provided, courtesy of the US taxpayer, makes it very attractive. And so there are many nationalities working in these private military contractors, often doing very hazardous jobs, like driving convoys from Kuwait or Turkey into Iraq, convoys that are attacked regularly by the insurgents. And it's a common phenomenon that with global labour mobility, workers from the developing world are often taking up the jobs that are the 3D jobs, dirty, difficult and dangerous. And then the families have to deal with the consequences at home of the 3 M's, mobile men with money. You've got a situation where men are coming back from Iraq, often being traumatised by the situation, and it's raising many concerns about how those men will reintegrate into society because of what they've been through.
I'd like to pick up on that issue a little bit later down the track, Nick. I suppose when it comes to hiring guns, money must be the primary motivator. Damien Kingsbury studies Indonesia. One of his many books is Power, Politics and the Indonesian Military. Around 70% of the income needed by the Indonesian military to operate comes from providing security to private companies. Who are its clients, Damien?
The Indonesian military provides security to a number of organisations, largely companies, large companies, very often transnationals, particularly in places like West Papua, where there's huge amounts of money to be made and where the companies believe that they need some sort of security because there is some sort of local independence movement or some sort of expression of local concern with some of their activities. Now, the companies more recently have hired protection through security companies, but the security companies then go and hire police or soldiers to work for them, even though they're still employed as police or soldiers.
So what do they want the army to do when they hire them for these contracts?
Well, the army essentially provides protection in the classical sense of a standover organisation. That is, you may say that you don't need protection, but if you don't, then the army or the police makes sure that you do.
Yeah, when I was reporting from West Papua, which is currently a western province of Indonesia, the Indonesian army, the TNI, attracted a lot of criticism for providing security to illegal logging operations. It wasn't just that they were supporting illegal logging that was attracting criticism either. It was, as you said, their penchant for fueling conflict to actually convince their clients that their presence, their guns, were needed. I mean, how common is that?
Well, that's very common in places like West Papua. They can foment trouble or disturbance. They can hire thugs. Indeed, they often engage in troublemaking themselves. In West Papua in particular, we saw with Freeport a few years ago now, when the United States introduced new legislation around financial transparency of its companies following the Enron collapse, what we saw with Freeport is it said to the TNI, look, we can't be sending you money under the desk, so to speak. We have to stop those arrangements. So it's been nice, fellas, but the show's over. What we saw very soon after that was an attack on American school teachers, in which 2 school teachers were killed. Now, that crime has never been actually solved, but the widespread belief is that the TNI was behind it, and it was actually a lesson to Freeport to say, well, look, you do need our protection. You still have to pay up. What's changed since then is that the companies like Freeport no longer pay directly to the military or to the police. What they do is they hire security companies, and these security companies then hire the police or hire the military to work for them in exactly the same capacity, which very often means no capacity at all. But there's an implicit understanding amongst big companies in Indonesia that you do have to pay a proportion of your profits to the military and to the police just to ensure that things go along smoothly, an extra tax that you have to pay to do business in Indonesia.
Mm. And what about other conflict zones? I'm thinking about Aceh, for instance. Are there similar stories coming out of Aceh about that type of phenomenon?
Certainly. The TNI didn't have any business interests directly in Aceh, as it still does in West Papua, particularly in logging and resource extraction, transport and so on. But the TNI did make an awful lot of money out of illegal businesses, gun running, drugs, smuggling, and of course its protection rackets, which were widespread. Now, with the signing of the peace agreement in Aceh, the number of military in Aceh has been cut by about half, maybe a bit more than half. So consequently, we've seen a decline in those types of businesses, but they still do exist. The Indonesian military is only funded to about a quarter to a third of its needs by the government, so it really does have to make up the difference through its private business activities and very often through criminal activities.
I mean, how does that work? Does that mean that they're not given enough money to actually pay the wages of the people they employ?
Well, yes, Indonesian soldiers are very poorly paid. There are subsidies given to them which actually help resolve the problem with the lack of actual cash in terms of housing, education for their children and so on. But again, there's not enough money to go around. So what happens is you find that the income that's earned from other business activities or very often from illegal activities actually goes towards paying for these other goods and services. If, for example, the total budget for the Indonesian military was, say, $6 billion a year, only about 1.5 or 1.6 billion of that would actually come from the Indonesian government. The rest is made up from income from private businesses that the military actually owns or through its black market activities.
Mm. I suppose Indonesia's not the only army that has to rely on private contracts, though. Can you give us a bit of a rundown of other Asian armies that have to turn to other income sources to keep operating, Damien?
Yeah, look, it's a common phenomena in post-colonial or post-revolutionary environments where what was the guerrilla army or the revolutionary army was not able to be provided for by the government-to-be of the new state. So they essentially had to provide for themselves, and that was very often through illegal methods, smuggling, businesses and so on. In Vietnam, we see the Vietnamese military is still engaged very deeply in a range of businesses. In Laos, it's a major economic player. In Cambodia, of course, the military is still a very big economic player, although it's been reduced somewhat and largely now is confined to illegal activities, particularly illegal logging, gem mining and smuggling and so on. Of course, in Burma, we see the military dominates, indeed runs the state, and the state exists essentially to support the military. The military owns the biggest businesses in Burma, so that's the most outstanding example. In Thailand, the military still owns banks, television stations, radio stations, a newspaper, and other businesses. So again, we see the military subsidising itself through a range of private sources. And of course, what this means is the extent to which a military is self-financing is the extent to which a government has no civil control over military function because it doesn't have the opportunity to say, well, if you don't do what we say, we'll cut off the money.
Yes, that's a significant problem. I'm wondering what other problems communities face as a consequence of this interplay.
Well, of course, when you get militaries engaging in business, particularly in the more questionable ends of business, where they become so-called grey businesses like protection rackets or indeed the black market, smuggling, gambling, prostitution and so on, what you see is a business that's essentially run by people with guns. Now, when you have an illegal business run by people with guns, that can only be described as a variation on the theme of the mafia. It's very big, it's relatively highly organised, it has a hierarchy, a very distinct structure, and it's deeply embedded in the state. And that, of course, is profoundly problematic, not just for the economic development of the state, but for its political development in terms of democratic institutions, representation, and, of course, human rights.
And I suppose the entrenchment of corruption might figure in there too when we're talking about these types of enterprises?
Oh, almost by definition. Of course, when there's money involved, and particularly when you're talking about grey or illegal activities, of course, there's a great deal of corruption. About two-thirds of the Indonesian military's income would actually come from black sources, that is, illegal sources. So by definition, it's involving a high level of corruption amongst the military hierarchy, payoffs, patron-client relations and so on.
Mm. I'd like to bring Nick McClellan into our conversation now, Damien. Nick, when you were looking at Fiji, what effect do you think that the continuing involvement in conflict will have on Fiji itself? I mean, will it help encourage a more violent response? Will it make, for instance, military coups more acceptable?
One problem for Fiji is that since 1987, it's had a series of coups by the Fiji military forces, first in 1987 under the then Colonel Rumbuka, a coup in 2000, and more recently, in December 2006, another coup led by the current army commander. But the role of people who've had international experience is quite significant in this. During the 2000 coup, for example, Parliament was taken over and politicians seized and held hostage by people who'd had special forces training, and they were led by a man named Ilisoni Lingieri, who'd served in the British SAS for many years. He'd fought in British counterinsurgency campaigns, been in Northern Ireland, been in Kenya, in Oman and other places. The experience of working overseas in these sort of counter-revolutionary warfare roles had been brought back into the Fiji Bali politic. Even more so after the events of 2000, Lingieri and members of the military unit that was involved in the parliamentary takeover set up a private company called Ronin, and Ronin has been involved in seeking security contracts. So, for example, Fijian soldiers went to Bougainville, an island in Papua New Guinea, the scene of a major conflict during the 1990s, and provided security services for people involved in criminal activities in Bougainville. The very name of the country, Ronin, says it all. That's a term from Japan, and a Ronin is a samurai who had lost his job after the death of the lord or the loss of the master's favour, and so Ronin roamed the country selling their services to people, whoever would buy their services. Think of the famous movie The Seven Samurai, you get
Indeed,
the idea.
It's a wonderful movie.
And so what we're seeing today on a global scale is these Ronin, people who've been involved in military activities, often as part of official armies, but finding more lucrative the opportunity to move into the private sector. And so on a global scale, you see large corporations like Blackwater or Aegis or others that are very highly professional corporations on a global scale, but they're often recruiting people who are moving between the grey world that Damien's described, between official and legal activities and activities on the edge of criminality.
I'm wondering about the family unit itself. When these men, predominantly men, come home to their families and they've been in situations of conflict with guns for a long period of time, I wonder what effect it has on, for instance, domestic violence.
There are groups within countries like Fiji and indeed around the world who are trying to address this question. The Fiji Women's Crisis Centre, for example, has an active program working with the wives both of soldiers and of people involved in private roles in Iraq. The effects of post-traumatic stress, particularly on people who've been involved in vicious conflicts like Iraq, plays out within the family. The Women's Crisis Centre and other women's groups are very concerned about men returning from these conflict zones without any support networks. At least the Fiji military forces has been supporting peacekeepers who come back with some level of support, but often people who've gone off as private individuals won't get any support from the company once their contract ends.
Mm. Going back to Indonesia, Damien, I'm wondering about the reaction of the Indonesian government itself to this real problem with military funding. Is there any shift toward actually finding the money to pay the military out of government coffers?
The Indonesian government has passed legislation, I think now 3 years ago or so, to say that all military businesses should be handed over to the government and that the military should divest itself. Now, there's a couple of problems with this, one of which is that no regulations to enact the legislation have been passed, and hence essentially nothing in that regard has yet happened. The other problem, of course, is that the legal businesses probably provide only about one-third of the Indonesian military's private income. The rest comes from illegal sources, and of course there's no way of saying, well, you have to hand over your illegal businesses, because the military, of course, says, well, they don't exist. Now, even if the military hands over its legal businesses, it is still going to retain its range of illegal activities, and they, of course, are the most problematic. The other side of it is the Indonesian government could pay for the Indonesian military in its entirety, but that would stretch an already fairly tight budget. Part of the problem here, though, is that there's a very widespread belief that if the Indonesian government did actually increase the direct funding to the military, that would end up only as a subsidy and would actually just add to the total pool of income available rather than replacing part of that income. So there's a deep structural problem here, and I think it's going to take a significant cultural shift within the Indonesian military to finally resolve it.
That was Associate Professor Damian Kingsbury from the School of International and Political Studies at Deakin University. He's written and edited a number of books. His latest is Political Development, published by Routledge this year. That was illuminating. Damian, thanks very much for being part of the program today.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Damian.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. Good to speak to you.
Bye for now.
Okay, speak to you later. Bye-bye.
Was Bob Brosman performing Scar Was Train on his latest CD, Lumiere. More details about that later in the program. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking with Pacific researcher and reporter Nick McClelland about the privatisation of armies. Nick, the clearest example in the Pacific region was the 1997 sand line crisis in Papua New Guinea. Refresh our memories about what that was about.
During the 1990s, there was a major conflict in Papua New Guinea, the island nation just to the north of Australia. One island, Bougainville, had a strong secessionist movement wanting to gain independence from Papua New Guinea, And through the 90s, there was a major conflict where ultimately the Papua New Guinea Defence Force and the police were unable to put down the Bougainville Revolutionary Army. At the centre of this conflict was a major mine, a large copper and gold project run by Bougainville Copper Limited, which is a subsidiary of the giant mining corporation Rio Tinto. As has happened in Africa, where there's been a need to protect and indeed expand operations for major oil, mining or energy projects, governments have turned to private military contractors or mercenaries to provide the military support to enable that to happen. And so in 1997, the then government of Sir Julius Chan, the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, hired a South African and British-based corporation to come in and provide military support to put down the Bougainville Revolutionary Army. Led by a man named Tim Spicer, a number of South African mercenaries were recruited to come in and were brought as far as Port Moresby, the capital of Papua New Guinea, and preparing a military assault against Bougainville, which would have seen many civilian casualties. The Papua New Guinea Defence Force, under then-General Jerry Singerok, rebelled against the arrival of these mercenaries, and through media exposure, their presence in Port Moresby was revealed. They were captured and ultimately expelled from Papua New Guinea without ever going into operation. But it caused a lot of concern in the Pacific. It's quite common to see this sort of operation by mercenary forces in Africa, but to see it spreading into a what's regarded often as a Pacific part of the world raised many eyebrows.
And the backwash was, of course, that the government lost power after the scandal. One of the leaders of that failed mercenary operation was, as you said, Lieutenant Colonel Tim Spicer. Prothap Chatterjee has been studying what Tim's been getting up to since then. Tell us about his role in Sierra Leone in 1997, Prothap.
So basically, Tim Spicer is somebody who came out of the Scots Guard, worked in former Yugoslavia, and saw the opportunity for fielding a private military in places of conflict, particularly when there was money to be made. And this is really what happened both in Sierra Leone and in Bougainville. He chose his clients based on who would pay him, as opposed to why they were there and what they were doing. So, for example, in Sierra Leone, the contract was offered to a couple of people, in fact, a company in Canada, that refused to take the contract. I know the guy, Alan Bell, because they felt it was a little dodgy. And the reason why Sierra Leone was dodgy was there was an arms embargo on the country. And what Tim Spicer was going to do was actually break that embargo in order to be able to intervene in the conflict. Now, it gets a little complicated because Sierra Leone at that time was taken over by a rebel group and the democratically elected government was outside the country. So Spicer was actually working on part of the democratically elected government but violating both UN and British laws in providing weapons to one side of the conflict. Now, it seems that, well, that's a small thing to pay for restoring democracy. Except you have to remember that in many of these conflicts, there's no such thing as the right side. One side wins an election, and therefore, in our minds, that means they're the good guys. But it doesn't mean that they're any less violent than the other side. And that's really the problem in Sierra Leone, is that Tim Spicer intervened on behalf of somebody that had been legitimized through an election, but was similarly violent to the group that he was trying to oust from power. And this is where he, you know, got into trouble with the law, because he was actually breaking the law. Just as in Bougainville, he had been involved in trying to mount a coup without really checking in with the armed forces and the parliament in that country. He simply was acting on behalf of somebody who wrote him a check. Now, because of these two scandals in Sierra Leone and in Bougainville, he actually got himself a bad name, and he retired from business. He actually went into assessing maritime security and did jobs in Sri Lanka and the Straits of Malacca and that sort of thing, and disappeared from sight. And his big break came after the Iraq invasion by the United States, when they were looking for somebody to provide overall guidance. And Spicer knew people, he understood how to bid for the contract, and, you know, he struck it lucky. He won what has now turned out to be a $500 million contract. But like a lot of the other private security contractors, you know, they submit a bid based on what they think they can do, not necessarily based on the actual experience. And Spicer actually had no experience in Iraq and was bidding on this contract lowballed everybody else, won the contract, and went in and started setting something up from scratch. And right away, like many of the other contractors who went in, he ran into trouble.
What was the contract for? What type of services was he actually required to provide?
Okay, so Spicer's company, Aegis, had a couple of different functions they were asked to do. One was they were asked to provide close protection services. That is to say, private security that would accompany high-ranking officials and protect their lives. The other thing that was actually much bigger was to run something called the ROCs. And these are centers set up all around the country that were supposed to receive information from the convoys, private security countries around the country, and help coordinate them. And the reason they were doing this is previously there had been uprisings, particularly in April 2004, when you had US military, you had private contractors, they weren't talking to each other since they weren't in the same chain of command. And it's not as you might imagine between private security contractors shooting at Iraqis, but actually the US military shooting at private contractors whom they don't know from Adam because they have no uniforms and no way to identify themselves. So the military at some point, realizing that this thing was a big mess, set up a system, communication system, that Aegis was in charge of running. Actually, by all accounts, they actually have done not too bad a job in terms of running these intelligence centers to track what's happening in Iraq. In terms of their private security, they in fact ran into a lot of trouble, particularly over the publication of a video that one of their people shot of how they were targeting Iraqis that came close to their vehicles and shooting into their vehicles. So they've been under a lot of scrutiny because of their trigger-happy practices, a little like Blackwater, but also because the people they had hired were evidently not qualified, had no background checks. And so
let's have a look at those people. Who did they hire? Who were the guns that were available for hire?
Well, I'll give you an example of a fellow. This has actually never been in the media, but his name is Frenchie, and Frenchie's real name is Rick Blanchard. And Rick Blanchard is this guy who's actually been in trouble with the cops a few different times in the United States, but also even in Iraq, where he was arrested when he was working for a company called Zapata for being involved in a conflict where his company was accused of shooting at the Marines. So he was kicked out of Iraq, and Spicer hired him to go work as a medic in Iraq for Aegis. Now, here's the interesting thing is Blanchard has no experience as a medic. He lied on his resume. And nobody bothered to check out to see if this guy had a police record, which he does. He eventually lost that job and came back to the U.S. and then got in trouble with the law once again because he got drunk and got into an altercation with the police. And this was just a couple of months ago.
It's the Wild West all over again, isn't it?
It's the Wild West all over again. We're speaking of Aegis here, but this is true of a lot of people. I'll give you other examples in more sort of general terms. The people that the United States is hiring to go train the police in Iraq, these guys are having problems with alcohol abuse. They're being pulled over for DUIs within the green zone. So the U.S. government is hiring barely qualified police officers who are getting charged with DUIs, driving under the influence, in Iraq. And these people are supposed to be training Iraqi police on how to effectively fight a civil war.
In his autobiography, Spicer writes, Sandline has five basic operating principles. We only work for legitimate governments. We will do nothing illegal, even for those governments. We will do nothing against key Western nations' foreign policies. We apply first world standards to all our military work, including respect for human rights, and we ensure client confidentiality. How do you reckon the practice measures up to the theory that he writes about in his autobiography?
We have numerous examples, especially right now, of Blackwater guards, Westerners, opening fire on civilians in Iraq. I don't see how Western standards are supposed to be better than Eastern or Southern standards or whatever. It's a colonial attitude that the white man knows how to fight clean, and Bougainvillians or Sierra Leoneans, are treacherous, murdering thugs. He says he only works for legitimate governments. Well, it is true that he worked for legitimate government in Papua New Guinea, but he was working on behalf of the government of Papua New Guinea to fight a community that has long been saying that its rights have been violated under various UN treaties. So because you work for a government that is the government of the day, does that mean that this is a legitimate operation. Lots of legitimate governments, legitimate in the sense they've been elected or whatever, often engage in internal civil wars. And that's exactly what happened in Papua New Guinea. In shipping arms to Sierra Leone, he broke UN sanctions and he broke British law. And that has been proven without the shadow of a doubt. Was he acting on behalf of the democratically elected government? Yes. Was he obeying the law? No. That, I think, is clear.
We're fast running out of time here, Prothap. Very briefly, you must have thought about this before. What do you make of the men who are doing this and their motivations? I mean, some of them seem to be playing Russian roulette with their lives for money. What do you think drives them into situations like this where they actually want to do this?
Poverty, broken marriages, unemployment. And typically, they come from the southeast part of the United States. This is the poorer part of the country. And sometimes they're people who are qualified and sometimes they're unqualified. But the thing is, that's not really the way to run police training or democracy building. You don't just scrape the bottom of the barrel with people who you know are hard up because they have no other source of income and then send them into battle and expect that they're going to do a good job.
That was Prothap Chatterjee, the managing editor of CorpWatch, which investigates and exposes corporate violations of human rights, environmental crimes, fraud and corruption around the world. Check out Prothap's excellent reports at www.corpwatch, that's spelled CORPWATCH.org. Thanks for dropping into our airwaves today, Prothap. As usual, very thorough, very wonderful, detailed explanations about what's going on in a part of the world that we don't often see.
You're so very welcome, Chris.
Bye for now. And also, time to say goodbye to today's co-host, Nick McClellan. Great to talk with you as always, Nick. Do come back and join us again soon.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks to Radio New Internationalist.
Bye for now, Nick. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD is called Lumiere, performed by one of this show's favourite artists, Bob Brosman. This is an amazing CD, combining musical influences of a range of Asian and Pacific countries. Bob and his colleague Renee LaSalle are also the mastermind musicians of our theme song, Dig Dig, which you're just about to hear now. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders, if you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website is where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Maher. I'm Chris Richards. Let's chat again next week.